All right, go ahead, talk. Say, you're listening to the Word Bros Podcast.
No.
Do it.
No.
Do it. Say, you're listening to the Word Bros Podcast. Do it. You're listening to the Word Bros Podcast.
TheWordBros.com.
Didn't jinx it because I was very worried because we mentioned it at the end of the Rich Woodall show that we were going to have Ed Brissett on this week, and lo and behold, he's here.
Yes, we did it.
I hate mentioning other guests that haven't happened yet because I don't want to jinx it.
Because sometimes things come up and they're busy outside of comics or they're busy with family stuff, and this pandemic has everybody busy with other things that they normally wouldn't be busy with. So when we mention somebody, sometimes we get kind of scared if they're going to be able to like show up to the podcast or not. But
go ahead, Kev. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, but one of the positive things about a pandemic is most people are at home, so they're going
to
want to record.
They better
a
be, damn it, as opposed to running around like a bunch of assholes, not wearing
without masks. Yeah.
Morons. But Ed is on. You know Ed from his work on Iron Fist, on the X-Men, all kinds of stuff. He's got a new Kickstarter coming out. It's actually out right now. He's got like 15 days left. It's called Catch and Release. He's going to tell us all about that right now. Ladies and gentlemen, Ed Brissett, everybody. Ed Brissett, how's it going?
It's going okay, man. It's going okay.
Is that the famous Ed Brissett Baja you're wearing right now? Like, is that it?
I'm wearing my drug rug. It's winter, so, and my office is in the basement. So I usually, if I'm working at night, I throw it on just to keep cozy.
That's awesome, dude. Can you pull back so we can get a full view of that thing? Because it looks pretty epic.
It's, it's just...
Yeah, look at that, dude.
It's what it is.
That's awesome.
It's straight out of 1999.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I grew up in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and like we have a pretty nice size surf community, and those things were all the rage back in the day. So
yeah, it's the surfers who brought them up. I know too much. I don't claim to be an expert, but like was reading up on them, and it's apparently surfers that brought them up to North America from Mexico because they were popular down there for. Because they're pretty like weirdly versatile. They'll keep you warm during the winter, but they're actually kind of cool during the summer.
Okay.
Cool as in like temperature wise.
Yeah.
I don't.
Dude, I think it's a good look, man. You rock it. You rock that thing quite well.
Yes. Yes. I would agree.
And I like the way you called it a drug rug. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, that's how we referred to it where I grew up.
Okay. All right. Now tell me why. I got to hear why did you guys call it drug rugs?
It's all the people who did drugs wore them.
It sounds so like it's when you say it. It sounds so kind of innocent and fun. Like, well, all the people who did drugs wore it. But I feel like if I said that or if Kevin said that, it would come across as like crass and judgy.
Ah, man, it's just like if you wanted to score some acid, you just look for one of these, and chances are the person wearing it would tell you where you could.
That's awesome.
I like that he's bringing it back. I like that that's not a popular fashion statement today, but you enjoy it, so you're going to wear it anyway. Ed Brissett, bringing back the Baja.
Well, it doesn't leave the house.
Okay, because I was going to ask you. So, like, when you go to the grocery store, do kids come up and you're like, hey, old man, where can I buy some weed?
No, not at all. It's literally, I just wear it. I just wear it in my office while I'm working. It's like my version of a Mr. Rogers cardigan.
That's cool.
I come down here, I change, I literally take off my shoes, put on a pair of slippers, and throw on my drug rug, and get to work.
Now, like Mr. Rogers, do you have a song that you sing?
I was going to ask the same question.
I do not have a song, but I should work on it.
Yes. I mean, it's not like you don't have tons of other things going on. I'm sure you got a couple of minutes to just put a song aside.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, man. Well, Ed, you have a Kickstarter that you're currently running, yes?
That is correct, yeah.
Tell us all about the Kickstarter that Ed Brissett is running.
Okay, so the Kickstarter is for a book, a standalone hardcover graphic novel, which is called Catch and Release, a murder book story. For those not familiar, Murder Book is a crime series that I've written for about a decade now. although it's been about 5 years since. So I guess I should just say I wrote for 5 years from 2010 to 2015, which used to be short, about 5 to 20 page crime stories that I wrote and self-published. I used to put them up online, and then Dark Horse collected and released them back in 2015 in a trade paperback sort of anthology format. But Murder Book is that series that I always wanted to get back to, wanted to do more. And so when this pandemic struck and I all of a sudden had a shit ton of time on my hands, I decided to sort of get back to it and ended up writing. when I sat down to write the story, I didn't have an outline. This is the first time where I've sort of written without an outline, just the inciting incident, just kind of wanted to go. I'm a huge Elmore Leonard fan, and this is how he claimed he used to write all the time. And I always thought, as much as I love Elmore Leonard, that it was kind of bullshit. I couldn't imagine, an outline gives you, you know, a safety net. You know what you're doing, and it gives you some guidance. So just kind of writing with that one was a bizarre experience, but I felt it worked well. Like I just kind of let the story breathe and go where it needed to go. And originally I thought it was going to be a 20 page story. It ended up being nearly 70 pages. So
damn, dude.
Decided to do a standalone graphic novel with it, with Lissandro Seren, who I worked previously with on a book called The Last Contract that came out through Boom also in 2015. But essentially the story is about, it's about an out of work. This guy's out of work. He's kind of broke. He's about to be evicted from his place, all sort of jazz. And he steals a car. And he initially sort of tells himself to, you know, that he's stealing this car because it's something he used to do when he was younger. And he just kind of wants to see if he can still do it. Like he's still got it, which like the irony of me, you know, coming back to Murder Book after 5 years, trying to see if I've still got it. Like that was one of those things that popped up that wasn't intentional, but definitely my subconscious fucking around with me. But he steals a car, and now that he has it, he's like, well, you know, he may as well do something with this stolen car. And so along with a friend of his, they come up with this plan because they don't have the paperwork that they could actually sell the stolen car. They don't really have the network that they could like maybe part out the car. So they come up with this plan to list a car for sale and sort of lure unsuspecting buyers out to a remote-ish location where then they can then rob them for the money that they were going to buy the car with.
All right.
Which is actually a thing that has, it's not something I made up. It's something that has happened in the past. There was a murder a few years ago about one of these sort of deals gone wrong. But that's sort of the inciting incident. On the other side of it, we have a Samar, who's a student who lives here in Halifax, and he's about to travel in 2 days to Vancouver, which is clear across the country, and his car just up and died, so he needs to buy a new car, and he needs to buy it quickly. So he doesn't have, you know, he's not necessarily going to have the time for all the due diligence that we might do with, you know, taking it to the garage, getting it checked out. He's going to rely on his own limited expertise. And of course, that just puts him, you know, right in the crosshairs of our car thieves. And the story sort of spins out from there. The deal goes bad. It goes wrong almost right away. And so the whole story is about dealing with the consequences of what happens on this day when they try and rob these two unsuspecting students and his friend.
That's awesome. Now, there's so much there that I want to kind of dissect from what you're telling us. I guess the first thing would be, you are kind of like the Ted Williams of crime writers. Like you are, when it comes to comic crime, you are the man. So like, do you feel any pressure kind of dealing with that reputation going into this book?
I don't know, because I don't see myself as having that. Like I don't really consider that. It's crime is just a genre I love writing, so I don't really think about how others view me as a crime writer.
Okay.
There definitely is some pressure in coming back to the series I wrote and then had put aside for several years. You know, you don't want to be like that, you know, the boxer who hangs it up and then comes back and, you know, and gets schooled, you know, by a younger boxer. I don't know where I'm going with that.
It's a good analogy.
No, it's a good analogy.
I just think about the Tyson fight that was last night. Anyway.
Now, did you watch any of that?
No, I didn't want to watch it, and I got enough. My brother watched it, and so I heard enough about it. Anyway, it's just one of these things that, like, personally, I love writing crime. It's anytime you sort of leave something for a period of time and then come back to it, there's always that worry that you're going to fuck it up, or you're not going to be able to, like, that by being, you've got ring rust, and by being away from it for so long, you've just sort of lost your connection to it.
Now, is it on purpose that your story, this, that your coming back story parallels the car thieves path? Like, is that on purpose? Did you do that on purpose? Because you're like, I don't know if I've got any ring rust and I'm going to bring that, it back.
Not initially, but when I looked at it afterwards, I was like, oh, you son of a bitch. Like, you know, it's like,
I'm a genius.
Just one of those things that snuck its way in there. So clearly it was in the back of my mind, right? I guess, you know, there is that worry, like coming back and doing something that you love, whether or not you can still do it, you know. I think in comics in general, there's sort of that rule, you know, whether it's unspoken, that like when a creator does a run on something, they leave and they just, you don't come back to it, right? You don't want to tarnish the memory of it. And so there was that worry for me. But I think this is, I'm incredibly happy with the story. And it was just, you know, with the pandemic, it's been like, pandemic aside, it's kind of been a weird year for me for other stuff. And so it was one of those things where I just needed to get back and sort of, I hate saying get back to my roots, but that was part of it. Just kind of feel that connection again, sort of center myself and feel what, just almost like rediscovering what excited me about comics in the first place.
That's awesome. Now, you said that you normally write from an outline, but this time you didn't. What does an Ed Brisson outline look like normally? Like, what is your process for outlining your story? We had a writer, Ram V, on a couple weeks ago, who says he never works from an outline. He just goes. And I started quaking in my boots hearing that. So, like, I would like to know what an Ed Brisson outline looks like.
That it all depends. I find that I'll say something today, you know, and then we'll check in a year and you'll be like, remember when you said how you outline? And I'll be like, well, I used to work like that. it constantly changes. So when I first started out, when I was first doing creator own work, I would do really loose outlines. And that would be like, I would take a sheet of paper, like, you know, I keep these sort of yellow pads here next to my computer, and I would just go down and write page numbers and leave three lines for each page and just write, you know, real quick, like this happens. But when I was doing creator own work, I didn't have a lot of, you know, books that I was working on. So I was working on one or two books at a time. So I could kind of like have a really loose outline and go in. And the thing I used to always say is I like to kind of discover the story while I was writing it.
Okay.
Which also sounds like a load of shit, but it's like, I'm not sure if I was just telling myself that to feel better about how I was working, or if that was the case. And I feel partly as a case. It's kind of like, I think when I get to the writing stage, I want some surprises left for myself when I'm writing, some things I can discover, and I like to leave myself enough room that I could explore something that might come up while I was writing the script that wasn't planned. That changed over the years when I started working for first DC and then later Marvel, and now like just, and every other publisher in between, where they kind of want to know where you're going for five issues or whatever that is. And I got to a point where I was writing four or five issues a month. So I really focused on making my outlines as sort of detailed as possible. I tend to, and I think this is I don't think this is the best way to do it, but I tend to just send my editors very plot heavy outlines. They're not really like character heavy outlines, and that's mostly because I want to leave a lot of the character stuff for myself when I'm writing. But yeah, I'll write like a very plot heavy sort of outline that gives them every single beat, every single, you know, what happens on every single page, what happens by the time we hit, you know, the fifth issue or whatever. So I'll start with like, you know, for a five issue, let me pull up right now while I have you guys on here. Look at my computer. I can tell you I'm working on a new book right now at Marvel, and I can tell you how long my outline for 6 issues was.
Dang, we're getting some exclusive content here. That's awesome.
No, I'm not showing it to you.
I know. But I mean, this is process, though. There are people that are process junkies, and they want to hear this kind of stuff.
So let's see. For 5 issues, I wrote and sent in a 12-page outline.
Okay.
For 6 issues, sorry. 12 pages, 6 issues. So roughly two pages per issue. And that's kind of standard. And I go really heavy so that they know what's going on in every single issue. There's no surprises. Just because the timelines are much tighter, you know, it's a train that needs to run on time. So they need to know what's going on so that when I hit the script stage, I can turn the scripts around a lot faster. That's how I outline for work for hire. When I outline for creator-owned stuff, I'm trying to go back to that 1 or 2 lines per page, just so long as I know where I'm going with the story, where my end point is. But with things like this murder book, Catch and Release, I didn't know necessarily where we were ending. It was a thing where I had a bunch of time on my hand and just wanted to jump in and just kind of figure the story out as I went. So I'm all over the place is what I'm saying. I don't have necessarily one standard approach to it. It really depends who I'm working for at the point.
So when you're playing in the Marvel sandbox, would you say that like, and you've gotten to do some really great characters that I feel like everybody loves, like Iron Fist and X-Men and stuff. And your process is different. Like, what's it like to play with the characters like you might have? I'm not sure if you did now. Grow up reading. Like, what was that like? How was that experience? Was it something that you were trying to do? Because I think some people go into comics with the idea they want to do their own stuff, and other people go into comics with the idea they want to do the big two stuff. So, where did you sit in that pile? Is what I'm saying.
I'm both. I'm of both worlds. Like, I've always hoped that I could. You know, part of why I did Catch and Release right at the beginning of pandemic as well is because, like, I've been working for Marvel now for 4 years, I guess, and I always thought I would still have time to do creator-owned, and I just never had the time to go back and do it. So for me, it did scratch two very different itches, but two itches that I feel need to be scratched. Like, the creator-owned stuff, I think, is... like, I want to say it's more personally fulfilling, but I want to say that in a way that doesn't take away from the stuff I'm doing for Marvel, because
right, I know what you mean, though, and I think people would know what you mean for that.
So yeah, so that's a thing. But with Marvel, yeah, I grew up reading X-Men. I grew up reading Iron Fist and you know, Logan, and a lot of the books I've had a chance to write are characters I grew up reading. So. My whole thing is to try and, with those books, I like the idea of like going back. What I'm always trying to do with them is try and go back and pull out some old threads from older issues, some things that, you know, that had interested me back then that maybe hadn't been explored. And sort of, that's usually my starting sort of jumping off point, and the story can end up not being that at all. But that's usually where I start from. Trying to go back and rediscover what made me love those characters, and then approaching the book from that position, and not always, like, I don't want to retread what's been done, but, you know, I want to at least honor what's been done in the past and make sure that you can feel the history of that character in the book that I'm writing. You know, I think there was, like, when I did Iron Fist, there's a ton of Iron Fist lore in that, but not in such a way that someone picking up the book couldn't enjoy it on its own, right? Like, it's anyway. So yeah, for me, it's really just sort of trying to do something that feels like it belongs in the sort of lineage of this character, but while also sort of forges forward and is not necessarily just looking in the rearview mirror the whole time. Does that make sense?
No, it totally does. Right. I mean, I imagine the pressures of writing a Marvel character with a storied history, it's got to be kind of nerve-wracking.
All daunting, yeah.
Because you got to, like, you have to please so many different masters.
Yeah, it's tough. And, you know, you get cases like, you know, working on the X-Men is real tough because there's been, what, like 17,000 X-Men over the years? And you will find that there is a fan account on Twitter for every single one of those X-Men who've existed. And if you in any way are seen as slighting someone's favorite character, they will come with chainsaws. They're not, you know, they're not afraid to let you know. And it's tough because, you know, you can, if you're doing an X-Men team, you know, generally you want to have like five or six players on the team. You don't want to go much beyond that, you know, for the main focus. And, you know, that means you're not using 16,995 characters. And people get mad. But even those five characters that you're using, and this is specifically with X-Men or X-Family, everyone has their favorite era of that character too. And if what you're doing is not exactly in that era, you know, you have, you'll have other people coming for your head as well. But at the same time, I try not to think about that when I'm when I'm writing it. I, again, just what's interesting about those characters to me, and how can we use these characters in a way that seems new and unique and not something we've already seen. And you know, it's a tough one when there's been so many stories for X-Men. But yeah, it's. I rambled on. I kind of drifted off the question.
Dude,
but
you're
like,
fine.
You're doing great.
This is the interesting stuff. Like, because when you were doing X-Men, it was you and Rosenberg that were writing X-Men at the time, right?
And Kelly.
So, Thompson, like, did you guys have like a meeting where you sat down and like had an X-Men draft and divvied them up, like? Or did the editor of the group go, okay, you get these guys, you get these guys, you get these guys?
How that one worked, and that was much larger cast than five, but we were flown down. We went to a summit in New York where we planned out the whole series in the Marvel offices.
Okay.
Matt Kelly, myself, Jordan White, I think C.V. Cebulski was there at one point, and Elise, I believe. I'm trying to remember who was all there, but this is about 2.5-3 years ago now. But yeah, we just kind of sat down and as a group kind of tried to figure out what the story was going to be. We all came with different story ideas that we
wanted.
And we sort of like almost like Frankenstein together the story. Like we took you know, bits from what each of us wanted to do, built a story. There were things specifically I wanted to do, you know, things Kelly specifically wanted to do, things Matt wanted to do. And we, you know, when we divvied up the issues, it was interesting because there was no clean delineation for being able to divvy up the characters.
Okay.
Because it was three writers on issues that were 20 pages each. And we reached being paid a third, for those 20 pages. So the way that we did it is we had our big giant outline for the whole, is it 10 or 12 issues? It's been a while now.
I think it was it 10?
I think it's 10.
Yeah. I think it was 10.
So it's 10 issues. We figured it all out. And then we'd had like very loose outlines and one of us would go and do a page by page breakdown of that issue and then send it off to the other two. And then we back and forth until we figured it out along with the editor. And then we divvied it up so that two people had 7 pages and one had 6. Whoever did the page by page outline only got 6 pages.
Okay.
The other people got 7. And we tried to get some sort of like, we would talk amongst ourselves about which pages we got, but we tried to always have like, you know, whoever's doing 6 is 6 sequential pages. Whoever's doing, so it's not like we're breaking up by scenes.
Yeah.
Because we had to, you know, we didn't have a lot of time with those, and we, you know, we couldn't add that extra stress. So, but what we do is then write the issue, and then we'd all go over it together to try and sort of unify the voice. And none of us would ever admit, I think, publicly, who wrote what pages. So it was always interesting to see which pages got attributed to which writer.
That's awesome.
Almost always wrong, which was kind of funny. But yeah, it was. But it was, again, you know, we had a ton of characters in there too, and so that one, that was a hassle to keep track of everyone.
Yeah, and that seems like, because you were saying that with the big two books, the train's got to run on time. This sounds like you've got a lot of cooks in the kitchen. So this sounds like it could have been a real nightmare.
It could have been. It was not too bad of an experience. Matt and Kelly and myself are all friends, and we're friends long before this.
Okay.
We talk online, you know, we talk to each other almost daily. So it was easier, I think, for the three of us, because we've already had a relationship before this. And so it was a little bit easier to come in and start working together. It definitely could have been, you know, bringing in three people who were not, didn't know each other. Could have been tough, but
that sounds
Have you ever co-written anything before that with any of the people involved in that, or have you co-written before? Because
no, so I co-wrote on that, and then I co-wrote on the first issue of New Mutants with Hickman. And those are my only co-writing experiences.
Okay,
because that's coming from us, because we co-write together all the time, and I can't think of working any other way now, because that's the way that Bob and I work is wherever someone gives the hot tag to the other guy, you're in. It could be page 7. It could be we don't plan it out. Whenever,
right?
Wherever we kind of do like a loose outline, like you're talking about, and then whoever tags in wherever is where we pick it up from. And the loose outline is just to keep us both on track as to where we're supposed to go. So that's why when you're saying writing without an outline, I couldn't imagine, because we both have very different ideas going in, like you're talking about. Both and that's all we do is co-write stuff. So it's like, that's why I wanted to ask about that, because everybody has a different way of doing this in comics. There's no one right way or wrong way. So
yeah, I definitely, you know, given my choice, I prefer just being by myself and writing, you know, stuck in my office.
Throwing on the drug rug, getting to work. Yeah.
but
singing a 90s hip hop song. That's what he's doing. Singing 90s.
But I think there's, you know, a million different approaches to it. I think I just, like, I come from, like, I self-published comics from 94 to 2010 before, like, you know, getting in and doing Murder Book and all that sort of stuff. And those I wrote and drew and did everything myself.
Oh.
So already, like, just me writing and working with an artist is giving up something that I used to do. And so I find my preference is definitely for just writing solo. That way I just find that, like, for myself, the success or failure is all on me.
That's cool.
Rather than me being able to blame Matt for something.
It's easier that way. Now, you said you wrote with Kelly and Matt, who are your dear friends. Did you have a relationship with Hickman before you worked on New Mutants with him, or did you guys just kind of like, hey, what's up, I'm dude, let's go kind of thing?
Yeah, not really. He had hit me up a few months before we started that to see if I'd be interested. He and I had met once or twice at Marvel retreats, but, you know, he wasn't someone that, you know, we chat all the time. And even, you know, the way that he works, it was completely different in that, like, he gave me like a sort of a rough outline. I beat out a longer outline for the issue than I wrote, and then the script went to him, and he wrote and rewrote a bunch of parts. And, you know, it went like that, and it was completely just
separate.
Yeah. Completely separate. It wasn't like, you know, with Matt Kelly and I, where we would be, you know, arguing story points, you know, in a chat with each other. It was very, very different.
Yeah. That's cool. Go ahead, Kev. I'm sorry.
I was gonna say you said you drew and I didn't know you drew before, but you're a writer now. And then did you start out as a letterer? So you could just like make your own comics from your basement in your bar.
I could.
You should just do that. Like, that's amazing.
I hate drawing.
I hate drawing. In the past.
That's why I stopped. I just, like, I went to fine arts and everything. I wanted to be a comic book artist growing up. I only started writing because I didn't know any writers. But yeah, after like 16 years, I realized that I just did not like the process of drawing at all. Like, it's just, I find just, you know, I'm not saying anything that any artist doesn't know, but like, I just find it absolutely just so frustrating and I don't like, I have a very cartoony style, so it doesn't necessarily kind of fit with the stories that I want to tell. And so I would get frustrated at that sort of disconnect. And so I just wanted to just do the, you know, focus on the writing and, you know, clearly that was where I started to get attention. So my art is not going to get me recognized by any major publishers, I don't think.
And I read too, you just quit lettering as well. Like you gave up your lettering chops as well.
Yeah. So while I used to letter, that's how I made my money originally in comics. I started lettering comics back in 2006, I guess. So okay. I started lettering Yaoi comics for a manga publisher.
Nice.
And I did that for 10 years. So I think I was writing at Marvel and still lettering Yaoi.
Damn, dude.
So for a publisher, up until I want to say I quit in either early 2016 or 17. But yeah, a lot of manga lettering, but I also did a lot of stuff for Image. I think I did some for Oni and Image were the two biggest publishers that I worked with frequently. And I did some stuff for Dark Horse.
That's cool.
If I did stuff for IDW, I cannot remember. I wrote something for IDW. I may have lettered, but I feel like someone else lettered it. Honestly, I wish I could remember that. I don't know why.
Cool. But you've done so many books. It's got to be hard to keep track of all the pieces kind of moving and shaking. I mean, it makes sense. It's understandable. Now, Kevin was telling me that at Heroes, when he first met you, when you guys were all hanging out, that he was pitching you his ideas for Iron Fist. Did you dig any of Kevin's Iron Fist ideas or nah?
No.
And how often does that happen to you when you're working on a big two book?
That happens all the time. I don't remember any of Kevin's ideas.
Which is good.
But it does happen.
Too many beers.
It does happen pretty frequently. But yeah, it's, you know, I'll get emails. You know, I have a disclaimer now on my site.
On the website, I saw it. Where hilarious. You can
email me. Because I literally had like a month where I was getting like emails from people who wanted me to do particular things in X-Men or X-Force or whatever books I was working on at the time. And one guy sent me a document that was like 10 megabytes.
Holy shit!
It was just huge. But like, the thing is, I can't look at them. I just have to delete them.
Yeah.
One of the worst offenders is actually my dad, who will be like, you know, he'll say, you know what you need? You need a like a vigilante who goes out and he breaks the kneecaps of those turds who run around like doing those graffiti tags all over everything. They're destroying personal property. I needed a vigilante to deal with that. He's like, I think that's something that everyone can get behind. I'm like, I don't think so. That's not gonna happen.
I pretty much did that. That's what I did. No, yeah. And not real bad because Ed was super nice about it.
Well, but Ed seems like a super nice dude.
He was super nice about it because I was drinking too many beers and I just said some stuff about like how like Iron Fist is one of my favorite characters and then I didn't tell him that he should do it. I was like, if I got to do that, I would do this.
That's
got to
be even worse though.
It was pretty bad.
Were we out eating Thai food when this happened?
Yeah, I believe so. Okay. No. It was the night before. You were drinking. I remember because I was buying beer for everybody. So it was Blue Moon. Like you were drinking a Blue Moon beer because they had them on tap at the bar. And then I had already been drinking before I went down to the bar. And then I had like three or four more with you. And then
right, you know what? And we're sitting with a friend of yours,
Robert.
He kept
beating me up about how I was pitching you, which I wasn't technically. Right. I was just super excited for him, and then my excitement translated into telling him what I would do because I had like
Kevin's the puppet time. Master pulling the strings.
it's absolutely fine. Like, and you know what? Like, I was talking to Kelly last night. She's trying to figure out something in one of her Captain Marvel issues, and I was doing the same thing. I was like, you know what you should do? So,
you know, I was just so excited.
We're all guilty.
Now, has anybody ever told you, like, this is what you should do, and they told you, like, fuck, that's really good? Like, has that ever happened, or are all the ideas normally, like, left park kind of whack job bullshit?
No, some of them are just, some of the ideas will come when I'm already in the midst of writing it, right? Like,
okay.
By the time that anybody even knows that I'm writing a series, I'm probably three issues in.
Okay, that makes sense.
So a lot of times the ideas that someone will pitch me are just things that could never actually work with the direction that we're going.
Okay.
So it's not something, you know, and I try to be cool about it. You know, I get it. Like, again, like I talk to friends who are writing characters that I love, and I have to stop myself from doing it. I'm not always successful in stopping myself either. So
yeah, I couldn't stop myself.
I imagine, and this is just me. This is just me. I've never been a big X-Man reader, but their crowd seems like the most, this is what needs to happen kind of people. And I don't know why, but it's just, I remember going to the comic shops and it was always the group of the X-Men fans that were always the most like, this is what's wrong with this book. And they seem like the most kind of militant kind of opinion havers.
At the risk of ruffling feathers, I don't think you're wrong. Like, I think
I knew it.
X-Men fans are very vocal about what they want.
I think they're passionate. Passionate is the word.
They are. Yeah. They are. And you know, I get it. You know, I have characters that you know, X-Men characters that I love. I almost, you know, I was at the last X-Men retreat that I was at when we started this X of Swords thing. At one point, you know, this is a spoiler for anyone who hasn't read X of Swords, it's very early on, but at one point it was possible that Glob Herman was going to get killed. And Glob Herman is like my guy. He's my X-Man.
Okay. I was going to ask, do you have a favorite one? And now you answered that. Yeah.
I nearly flipped the fucking table. Like, really? I was like, and I'm a quiet guy, and I don't normally like get loud, but I was like pounding on the table saying like, no, like, no fucking way. Like, you can't.
No fucking Herman. Way. This is awesome.
You can't do it. So, yeah, I get it. You know, in that moment, I became one of those folks
who
come at me. So, I understand it. I think, you know, there's a bit of, like I said earlier, everyone has their favorite X-Men, and they're very protective of that character. So, if anything happens with that character that feels like a slight or anything bad happens to that character, you know, that segment is going to get angry. You know, unfortunately, when you're telling these sort of like peril-based stories, bad things got to happen.
Something's going to happen.
Yeah.
Okay, now tell me this, Ed. You've got Uncanny X-Men. It's your book. Ed Brisson solo. You're doing this thing. You're writing it. You're working with whoever you want to work with other than that. Who's on your team? So Glob Herman is the leader, obviously.
Not the leader. He'd never be the leader.
So who's the rest of the Ed Brisson X-Men? Who's the rest of your team?
That's a tough one. So I think I would have Logan, definitely.
Okay.
I would have Armor. I would have Magic. I would have Glob. So I feel like you gotta have, like, you know, Beast and Cyclops. Like, they just, you know, Jean. And with the Jean Grey, like, I'm like, I don't know. It's weird. So it's either be Cyclops or Jean Grey. I don't know.
Okay.
And then just Boom Boom, I think, because I just like writing Boom Boom. She's
And Maggot, just because he's there.
No, I'm just kidding.
That's awesome. It's so cool. I feel like everybody in the comics world would have a different answer for that.
So yeah, I think so, yeah.
It's kind of cool, though, how like you gravitate towards which characters. Now, is there anybody in the Marvel Universe that you haven't written yet that you're waiting to kind of like you're chomping at the bit to get to? Or are you kind of satisfied? Because you've written like a lot of great characters in the Marvel Universe, so...
Yeah, I think, you know, I haven't had a chance to write Daredevil yet. I would love to write Daredevil.
Why hasn't that happened? Who can we contact to make that
happen? Because that seems natural with you in crime stories. Daredevil's perfect for like a crime.
Look, if somebody wants to take Chip Zdarsky out,
he's not putting contracts out. He doesn't want it marked, but if you do, there's, you know.
I'm not saying killed. No, I like Chip a lot.
Don't hurt Chip. Him on our podcast.
No,
that's you know what. But you just gave us some clickbait though. We can put out who did Ed Brisson say he wanted murdered?
Question. Yeah, but Daredevil's one. Spider-Man for sure. I think, you know, Spider-Man is just kind of like it is the go-to. I think a lot of people come to Marvel and they want to write Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I do have a Punisher book that is coming out at some point. I don't know what it is. So he was another character for me.
That's fun. Is he going to get the graffiti artists fucking up people?
Yeah, that's the whole thing.
That is the whole plot right there. Yeah. Punisher versus graffiti.
Yes.
Punisher cleans up the streets and he's like actually just painting walls and stuff.
It's Punisher property damage. And he's just, he's out there with a paint can and gray paint.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
That sounds cool, man. I did it for you, Dad.
They're my big ones, though. Like Spider-Man, Daredevil, in terms of characters I haven't written far. My oddball one that I want to do is Speedball. I'm a big Speedball fan.
That's a good one.
He's a good character. I always liked the New Warriors, but that came out in the 90s too. Like, and that was one of those books where it was like they were promoting alongside like the New Mutants and stuff. Where that's when I started to drift away from comics and get more into like
Speedball's a good one.
Yeah,
he's fun. He's a lot of fun. I did a Marvel. I had a one pager in Marvel 1000. That was a Speedball story with Jorge. Oh God, Fornes. Don't know how to pronounce his last name, but he and I got to do a Speedball story with Jordy Belair on color.
That's awesome.
It's just a one pager, but it was a ton of fun.
That's cool.
That one. So, but I'd love to do a Speedball series or even just a one off.
That's cool. Now, Kevin was also saying that you're a big '90s hip hop guy, right?
That's true. Yeah.
Yep. Nice. Who's your favorite? Who's your favorite group?
Favorite man? I don't know. Like, I'm kind of all over the place. Like, I was a huge, like, massive Public Enemy fan back in the day. I was like, anyone who listened to hip hop in the 90s probably remembers there was that period when Ice Cube left NWA and you had to either be in the Ice Cube camp or the NWA camp.
That was a tough time.
It was firmly in the Ice Cube camp.
Well, No Vaseline is probably the best diss track of all time. Fuck.
It's so nasty, but yeah, it's
great.
I think Naughty by Nature is one of those groups that just doesn't get enough credit. I think a lot of people see them as sort of anthem-y, sort of pop hip hop, but
that's like, what you say, pop hip hop. Yeah.
Yeah. But Tretch is a fucking killer MC.
Like, really?
I think he does not get nearly enough credit. I think like in hip hop folks recognize, but I think, casual hip hop fans don't understand how good and how influential he is.
Okay.
Black Sheep was another one that I love.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Strobe Light Honey, dude. Strobe Light Honey.
And Tribe Called Quest, a huge Tribe Called Quest fan. Yeah. I don't know, man. There's a ton of stuff from back then. You know,
De La Soul.
Big De La pun. Soul. De La Soul. Yeah, I love De La Soul too.
Yeah, me too.
That sort of, I was really into that native tongue family sort of stuff.
That's cool.
Back then. Yeah, I don't know. There's a ton of stuff. I'm just looking at my record collection here to see who I'm missing. But those are like back then big ones. I was huge Run. Like I started listening to hip hop in the 80s with Run DMC, and I'm still like a massive Run DMC fan.
Which is crazy because the year after that we hung out at Heroes, DMC was at Heroes walking around.
He was that year.
Was he? Did you get to see the concert?
No. Because I went out to get some food and I came back, literally came back just after we walked through to the auction.
I took video.
Just finished.
I'll send it to you.
All right.
That way you didn't miss it.
Kevin, somebody was bragging.
Yeah, somebody dragged me out.
I was bragging. Hoyt Silva and I got to go and we were very like happy to go and meet DMC because like we both really love Run DMC, so it was a lot of fun for us.
How can you not? I mean, they are a great hip-hop group and they have the best Christmas song ever.
Sure, that's true.
Christmas in Hollis is the best Christmas song ever.
That's the only time I've found that I actually have been really like super starstruck was when I was setting up my table one year in New York Comic Con and NYCC, and I was sitting at my table and DMC just like walked by my table like 3 feet in front of me and I couldn't function. I just couldn't even speak or whatever. I actually just sat down for like 10 minutes just to sort of collect myself because I was such a massive fan of theirs growing up. And still like, you know, still have several Run DMC tracks on my workout playlist and stuff. So
that's cool. What do you bench?
No, I'm strictly cardio.
Just kidding with you, Jeff. Yeah.
Do you even lift, bro?
I do not even lift.
That's awesome. But yeah, because I've seen that's the weird thing because I of course, I'm aware of Naughty by Nature growing up listening to hip hop, but I never really got into like their album stuff. So you're saying I should go upstairs and listen to Naughty by Nature on Amazon Music and I'll be pleasantly surprised?
Yeah, throw on like 1993 or what was their first one was just self-titled.
It was self-titled, yeah.
Yeah, so those two albums, like I think like the tracks outside of the ones.
The radio songs.
Yeah, like I think Ghetto Bastard and Uptown Anthem are maybe more indicative of what they were like on those first two albums.
Okay, okay.
They definitely did become sort of more poppy and anthem-like on later albums. But Tretch, you can just fucking rip. Like, that's cool. It's okay. Crazy. Yeah, you should give them a listen. They're right, good albums.
I'll check it out.
I think they sometimes just get glossed over as like weird, like one-hit wonders or whatever. But no, dude, he's tight. He can do it, man.
It's weird. It's like what you say, Bob, about Black Thought and the Roots. Everybody sleeps on Black Thought. He's amazing.
That guy, yeah.
He's dope. Like, yeah. Black Thought's dope. I've always liked him.
Well, people think Black Thought. They think the Roots. They think Jimmy Fallon. They think, ha, 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 we're going to play Tiny Desk.
Yeah, but that's not like, it. Yeah.
That guy just fucking wrecks on a regular basis. Have you seen the freestyle flow he did, the 10 minutes on YouTube?
It's on Charlamagne the God.
Yeah. No, what was his name? I can't. Funk Flex.
Okay. That's your.
He did a 10-minute freestyle on Funk Flex's radio show on YouTube. That is fucking crazy.
Believe it, man. Did he? Yeah, I'm a big fan of. I'm a big fan of the Roots. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And Brisson, you are a well-schooled man in hip hop and comics. You're an Elmore Leonard fan, which is like the fourth time Elmore Leonard's come up recently on this podcast.
Oh, really?
Makes me happy. Yeah, because Elmore Leonard's the best. Like he's that kind of guy that you're gonna get in, you're gonna get out, and you're gonna get a good story.
Man, no, I you know, when I first discovered Elmore Leonard was when I was in fine arts, my first year of fine arts, and I discovered one of his books at a used bookstore, and read it in 24 hours. And then went back to the same used bookstore, and I think I bought like 13 more of his books. And I didn't go to school for 2 weeks. I stayed at home and just read Elmore Leonard for like two weeks. And then dropped out of fine arts later that year.
So it's Elmore Leonard's fault that you dropped out of college?
I think so, yeah.
That's awesome. But look, he would be so proud of you because, again, you are like one of the most prolific and best crime writers in comics. So you must have learned something.
I hope so.
Right? So you're making Elmore Leonard proud.
Yeah, well... If he's looking down on me, let's hope.
That's awesome. Ed Brisson, thank you so much. Your Kickstarter is running for, you have, I got it right here.
It ends on December 16th.
All right. So this will be out tomorrow. So you got 15 days. You're already over your goal, which is fantastic. So congratulations on that. Funded in 6 hours. That's got to be.
That's amazing.
That's got to make you feel good about yourself, right?
Yeah, it was kind of exciting. I was very, 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 very nervous about doing a Kickstarter. It was great.
Now,
great
did you get any blowback from like dudes on Kickstarter being like, fuck you, Ed Brisson, you're a Marvel guy. What do you need Kickstarter for? Did you get any of that or did you get, have you got?
Oh God, I hope not. I haven't seen any of it directly.
Well, that's cool.
That's good.
Yeah. So, you know, I hope that's not out there, but, you know, it's, I get it. You know, I think some folks, I don't know. I don't get it because, you know, Kickstarter is big enough. People can back whatever they want. And I was talking about, you know, on my Twitter the other day, I feel like this project is a niche project that publishers just aren't going to take a risk on and take.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hardcover, you know, a crime book, you know, standalone. It's not cheap to produce and I can't see publishers taking out. So Kickstarter was the only sort of thing.
So, I love how your tone changed. You're like, oh yeah, man. No, I mean, I get it. Fuck those guys. Like it was very quick to like split that up, and you did it like in such a gentle and grandiose style that you have.
I was taking a moment to consider it, but you know, screw it. I like there's enough room on Kickstarter for everyone. You know, I think it's a good place to get unique projects out. And I think that, you know, there are pros much bigger than me who've launched projects in there. And I think there is a net benefit to that it brings more people into Kickstarter.
I can say the same thing. I was going to say the same thing.
Kevin and I say the exact same thing. It's like, dude, if people are going to discover Kickstarter through Keanu Reeves and then discover other books on Kickstarter, perfect. Like, that's wonderful because you're growing your audience, because the direct market audience and the Kickstarter audience are very different. Like, they don't really intersect.
Yeah. So that's awesome. And if it takes Keanu Reeves to get you to sign up for Kickstarter to mean that you back Metal Shark Pro 3, I'm all for it, whatever. It doesn't matter, you know, because we all benefit at the lower levels from guys like you signing up and doing a Kickstarter, because it gives validation to the platform that people from the direct market believe is for unpublishable projects, which isn't necessarily true.
Right.
But that's a perception. So.
Sure. I agree. I think it's a great place for indie. Like, you know, I wish it was around when I was self-publishing, you know, 15 years ago.
Yeah, totally.
You know, it would save me plenty.
But
I think it's a great platform. I think it's a good way for, you know, people who are coming up to sort of get, you know, their projects out there and get recognized and get seen. Because even, you know, if I have my Kickstarter up, Kickstarter will recommend other projects.
No, totally. Yeah.
For backers. You guys know.
Yep.
You guys know how this goes.
So, Ed, when can I send you my ideas for Punisher? Like, do you want those after we're done, or when do you want
them? I've got ideas for Punisher.
I got like 40 gigabytes of information that I think you need.
He's lying. Yeah. It's all Spider-Man stuff.
Sure, you can email those to me at Matthew Rosenberg at
gmail.com. Ed Brisson, thank you so much, man.
All right, thanks a lot, man.
That was Ed Brisson. His Kickstarter catch and release is on, of course, it's on Kickstarter right now as we speak. Head on over there, check that out, and back Ed's book. Thank you so much for coming on. Kevin, that was a good get, man. That was a good get, Ed Brisson. You did it.
I mean, I do amazing things sometimes. And if you want to follow Ed to hear about what he's writing next, or what the secret Marvel project he was talking about on the podcast were, or who he's going to merc next to get Marvel books. No, I'm kidding. it's at Ed_Brisson on Twitter. So follow Ed, like give him a follow, tell him what he's doing. That's great that you love, and come back next week and listen to Word Bros give you another awesome podcast.
Yeah. So thank you guys so much for listening. Happy December, because I think this is coming out December. This will be out. Is tomorrow December 1st? No,
tomorrow's November 30th.
Oh, it's the end of November. So you still got some time. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate your patronage and all that stuff, and your participation in the podcast. You can follow us. What are we at? Word Bros Podcast.
At Word Bros Podcast. Twitter.
Let me make sure.
It's at Word Bros Podcast, and you can follow us individually. I'm at Kevin_Cuff, and he's at BFrance19.
Yeah, at Word Bros Podcast. Don't follow at Word_Bros, because that was our original Twitter handle that we forgot the password to.
But yeah, because we're idiots.
Yeah, it's at Word Bros Podcast. That's us, Word Bros Podcast. Follow us there. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you can find your podcast wonderfulness.
And leave us a rating.
Yeah, sure. Feel free. Yep. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it. We'll be back next week with more fun time.
You're listening to the Word Bros Podcast, thewordbros.com.